Hey,
we're back.
Excited?
I'm super excited.
Good.
I have a couple of bigger topics that I wanted to talk about.
Okay, I have a lot of big topics and small topics as well.
Really?
More than I expected.
Yeah, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole with my big topic as I was thinking about it. So, who should go first?
Well, do you want to start?
I'll start. Let me start. I'll start with my biggest topic. And that is references to vertigo.
Okay.
And when we last spoke in the previous episode, which we published, we mentioned that there's a moment where the camera whirls around Will in a way that's reminiscent of the famous kiss from Vertigo. And I posted that in the show notes and just watched that famous kiss scene from Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I watched that, I was just like, well, there's no way I'm not watching Vertigo now. Who can just watch 1 minute of Vertigo? So I rewatched it since we last spoke. And, you know, it's never a mistake to rewatch Vertigo.
No.
I've seen it 1 trillion times.
Yes.
And it's so great.
It's fantastic.
And I know, like, BFI poll famously made Vertigo the best movie ever a few years ago, and it sort of sat there. I can imagine disagreeing with that, but I can't really imagine arguing with it. Like, what are you going to argue with that after you see Vertigo, that it's not worth considering as the greatest movie
exactly.
ever made? It's really incredible. So I really enjoyed it. But one of the things that's fun to do is to watch these things while thinking about our Hannibal rewatch. And one bigger point is, I know we often, when we talk about Hannibal, and I think I do this maybe more, is just, I like to point out what a shot or a scene or what a line of dialogue reminded me of. And I hear myself doing it, and sometimes I'm kind of wondering, like, why, like, what, to what end am I just saying, oh, this reminds me of this, this reminds me of that. But I think with Hannibal, it's appropriate, because Brian Fuller himself has characterized Hannibal as a work of fan fiction, right? And as such, it's literally a conversation with the audience about pre-existing works of film and pre-existing works of fiction and other influences. So I think finding these little Easter eggs, references to other things besides stuff specifically from, like, the Thomas Harris universe, is part of the fun. And I think that's the explicit intention of these things. I don't know really if that's the explicit intention, but it feels like, because the show is in a conversation with the audience about broader popular culture, it's makes sense to pay attention to these other references and think about what they might mean. And sometimes it's just kind of fun, like when there's the visual kind of Kubrick references, you know, the bathroom from The Shining and things like that. And sometimes it's more profound, like when Hannibal paraphrases Spock's death speech to Kirk from Star Trek II. That moment for the Star Trek audience was literally 20 years in the making for those fans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're familiar with that, or if you share the enthusiasm for it, what's happening is, and if you recognize it, Hannibal, the show, is successfully borrowing from or channeling the emotional power of that moment, which is so powerful to people who are familiar with it. And it underpins and enhances the power of what Hannibal was saying. It's not required, but it does
inform.
It does inform it. And as you know, and you were telling me anyway, that scene, the Spock Kirk scene from Star Trek II, the Spock death scene, is like one of the canonical seeds of fan fiction. So that seems like that underpinning really matters. And that's why I think you can extend it even further to watching something like Vertigo. And there's just a lot of good, I think, Hannibal-related archaeology to do with Vertigo. So here are my some thoughts about that as I was rewatching it. Some things really struck me, like the opening credits of Vertigo. It starts with a close-up of an eye. And it starts with a close-up of an eye that then becomes obscured by spiral patterns. And as we delve into it, there's more spiral patterns and more weird stuff happening, kind of like, it's almost like we dove into the eye and we see all the kind of craziness that's going on behind it. And by the end of the credits, we pull back out and we're looking at that eye again. And Hannibal's full of eyes.
Uh-huh.
And how eyes behave and what they represent and what they see.
What's behind them.
And what's behind them.
What they're hiding.
And even episode 5 has a very important eye moment, which you talked about previously, the dilation of Hannibal's eye, which mirrors eye dilations that happened in previous episodes, like when Hannibal injects James Gray with heroin and his eye dilates, right? So there's a lot of that eye stuff. So that just really struck me immediately in the opening credits of Vertigo. Plus, there's a spiral pattern in the eye, like the
God's eye,
like the mural. Okay, so that was just one thing that jumped out. Another thing, though, that really surprised me, and this really surprised me when I was watching the kiss scene, is the use in Vertigo of dream imagery and fantasy as a method of, or as a signal of, reconstruction and deduction and transformation.
Yes.
And transformation is like the central theme of Vertigo, right? Obviously, it's a major theme. It's about people transforming. It's about a transformation being inflicted on someone, even.
Transformation being inflicted on someone because they are an obsession or love object.
Yes, but it's a transformation that not only that, it's a transformation that's aggressively being imposed on one person by another, but it's also when the person who's being transformed is also complicit.
Yes.
But less willing to openly acknowledge that it's what they want.
Yes.
That's happening in Vertigo.
Yes.
And it's happening with Hannibal and Will.
Yes.
I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to argue that most fiction doesn't involve some sort of transformation, but this is really specific.
Yes, the theme actually is, well, the theme is obsession and transforming, I mean, in a very harmful way, transforming someone to meet your obsession, to transforming someone to be the image of your obsession. Into the image of your obsession, into the image of the thing you want.
Right. Yet Judy Barton, who's Kim Novak's character, she's actually transformed twice in the movie.
Yes.
She's transformed once by oh shit, what's his name?
The husband.
The husband.
Yeah.
Gavin Elster.
Yes, yes.
So she's transformed once by Gavin in a transactional way. And then she's transformed again by Scotty, Jimmy Stewart's character, in a way that she is more complicit with. She's offended by it, but she also wants it. She's alternately resistant and complicit. There's a lot of stuff about her resenting it, but also being tempted to stick with it. Her packing her clothes, unpacking her clothes, hiding the Carlotta dress, taking it back out. There's all that kind of stuff going on. So she's really conflicted about it, but ultimately she chooses to be complicit. And there's even a moment of counterfeit transformation when, or counterfeit occupation of a transformed space, like that. And that's Midge, who's Barbara Bel Geddes.
Oh yeah, when she paints herself.
Paints a picture of herself as Carlotta as a way to seduce or flirt with Scotty. And he's completely offended by it. And that sort of reminds me of the that sort of reminded me a little bit of Tobias and the orderly.
Yes.
Because you were pointing out last time that they're fake, they're inadequate to serve the purpose for Hannibal that Will would like to serve. Or, well, the orderly doesn't serve that purpose for Hannibal. But they are, but actually in a way, I'll correct that. Tobias, flat out, not the serial killer friend that Hannibal wants. The orderly is not the manifestation of Will's murderousness that Hannibal wants. So both of them are kind of a counterfeit Will in a way that Hannibal rejects. So I just thought that really, that just jumped out at me while I was watching Vertigo, is that there's this counterfeit transformation that someone else is trying to participate in. And Scotty is so put off by it. She shows him that painting and he's says, just like,
not good, Midge, or what does he say? Not funny.
Yeah, he's
Midge.
Like, no, no, no. And he just like kind of wanders out of her apartment.
And then that's when she's like hitting herself in the head. Oh.
I feel like her, I mean, so much has been written and spoken about Vertigo. I guess I just feel like she's underappreciated. Her performance is underappreciated. It adds so much texture.
Yes.
Okay, so back to back to dream imagery and reconstruction, right? There's a scene where Scotty has a nightmare that really had a Will reconstruction moment to it, where he's dreaming that Madeline Elster's grave is empty and that Carlotta is hanging out with Gavin and there's that old piece of jewelry, right? And
don't keep a souvenir from a murder, though.
Well, that's funny because I was gonna bring that up, and I will bring that up.
Okay.
I think a lot of movies and TV will misuse dreams and dream imagery. Sometimes I think it's just becomes a lazy form of exposition, a way of just laying out what's going on because someone doesn't have the patience or imagination or just the time to really, you know, but that doesn't happen in Hannibal. And that really doesn't happen with this dream. This dream has the feeling of a real dream. There's like fragmentary images. He is sensing what's really going on, but it's not explicit or expository, but all the pieces are there. So it has that quality of a real dream. And then what makes it signature Hitchcock, of course, is by this point, Hitchcock's actually told us what's really going on. So we're ahead of Scotty. And it's actually frustrating or suspenseful to see that he hasn't put it all together because we know what's going on. And the show Hannibal does this kind of thing so well. And because it's a TV series, it's even better, right? It can afford to keep things fragmentary for longer. And the dreams get to have a trajectory before they become explicit. Like Will is dreaming about the Raven Stag all the way at the beginning of season one.
Right.
And a whole season goes by before Hannibal actually grows horns out of his own head in his dream imagery, you know?
Right.
So that, I thought, is just a good example of a movie that uses this dream imagery really well, that uses dreams properly and actually feels like dreaming. It's fragmentary. It's not lazy. It's not used to push things. It's just used to create a sense that somebody is starting to put stuff together, but it hasn't all gelled for them yet, which is what's always happening with Will's dream imagery.
Always.
So then, even more so, when we talked about the famous kiss scene and how Will's moment of reconstructing Beverly's death kind of uses that same kind of whirling camera thing, that great effect where the camera's whirling around someone in one direction, the background seems to be moving in another direction. Vertigo's probably the canonical example of that, and probably no movie's ever going to use it better. I don't know if Hitchcock invented it for that or if he just perfected it, but it's the ideal use of that. And it's profound. It's important for the movie because it's such a climactic moment. It's also so technically notable that I think it confers a sort of importance to the proceedings just because it's so complicated and so interesting. So it's not something to be used lightly. So when it happens to Will, it's important when the camera treats him that way. But what I really like about that kiss scene is, and it's something I hadn't really, I always knew, but hadn't really thought about, but now that I'm thinking about it in terms of Hannibal, during the kiss, when things are spinning, right, the kiss happens in her little apartment.
And they go into the old monastery.
Right. And during the kiss, the background...
He sees it.
Yeah. That's the thing. It the background changes and it's not just atmospheric. Scotty looks up and he looks around. He sees it.
He's disturbed. He's disturbed by it.
Disturbed by it. This time I watched it, I thought he was reacting to it as if it actually happened, and he makes the choice to embrace it because he continues to kiss her.
Yes.
So, and here's where the Hannibal relationship seemed interesting to me. That means that the fulfillment of his embrace with her pushes him over the line into insanity.
Yes.
He's embracing not only her, but he's embracing his departure from reality, which for a lot of the movie has been intolerable to him. For a while, reality has been intolerable to him, and here he is just stepping through that door. And from that point on, he's no longer governed by traditional morality or rules. So when he does like see her necklace and realize what's been done to him, he reacts really dangerously. And without any sense of consequence. And we always joke about him saying, we've been joking our entire lives saying apt pupil to you, or very apt pupil.
And then what did he do? Did he train you? Did he rehearse you? Did he tell you exactly what to do, what to say? You were a very apt pupil too, weren't you? You were a very apt pupil. But why did you pick on me? Why me?
But like, we joke about it, but when you watch that scene,
scary.
It's one of the most profoundly unhinged things ever put on film.
He sounds insane when he says it. He sounds insane and violent.
And violent. He's flinging her around those rickety stairs, and he says other things. Why'd you have to pick on me? Like he's lost it completely, and he is not bound by rules here anymore. So the embrace figures it sort of signals that completion of a transformation and this madness. And by the way, it's followed by a fall shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. A transformative embrace where somebody crosses over the line into a world with its own rules and can no longer tolerate existing in this world. And they clash, and the only, in the case of Vertigo, the only recourse is for one of them to die. But certainly in Hannibal, there's that big embrace, big moment of transformation. And in the finale, they fall right over the cliff. It just seems so closely aligned, right? And then the thing that you said before was the last thing I wanted to say about this, because during his crazy speech, Scotty says, you shouldn't keep souvenirs of a killing. You shouldn't be that sentimental.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like that could be the tagline for season two of Hannibal. He's in a way wrong. She's not keeping it as a souvenir of a killing. She's keeping it because it keeps her emotionally tethered to this experience that she had with Scotty that she can't admit to or can't acknowledge or can't fulfill. So when he says you shouldn't be that sentimental, it's almost like he's talking to himself, but he's also so sad to realize that she really loved him and like this is what it's come to.
It's also she's his souvenir of a murder that he's sentimental about. He shouldn't be keeping a souvenir of a murder.
Right. Exactly. Now, he would have preferred it if she'd simply done this for the money and not fallen in love with him. It would have been a lot easier on him.
Because then she would have just gone.
She would have just gone.
He wouldn't have found her.
But she's been, yeah, and she's been secretly wishing they would reunite, and she kept this sentimental object. I mean, of course, it is the souvenir of a killing too.
Yes.
But it's her emotional attachment to the souvenir that's actually her undoing.
Yes.
And so the last time we talked about the souvenir that Hannibal kept of Beverly's killing, her kidney, and then when he eats it, he has this unusually happy reaction to it. He really smiles, and it tasted better to him because it's Beverly, or maybe because it represents him further keeping Will to himself because he's removed one of her people from the mix. But this will also be his undoing in a way. The emotional resonance of the kidney and the satisfaction he takes from removing it, it's a souvenir of the murder, but the fact that he couldn't resist taking it for emotional reasons or enjoying it for emotional reasons is in like great part what's going to be his undoing, right?
Yes, 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 yes.
The sentimental souvenir of a murder.
Yes, it's great.
That brings me to the end of my thoughts about Vertigo, but well, it was so great to be thinking about these things in the Hannibal context. And one would assume Brian Fuller's quite familiar with Vertigo, but you know, I just feel like, again, as a act of archaeology, you can draw all these almost straight lines between Vertigo and Hannibal with these influences that you see in it, you know?
Yes. Yes. I thought about Vertigo 2 in a slightly different, and first of all, this is really fascinating, everything you said, and I have a lot of different thoughts about it. I mean, it's also just very interesting that, I mean, you have a lot of blurring of who's who, much like in Hannibal, you have a lot of, when you make this comparison, you have a blurring of who's who, because Jimmy Stewart as Scotty is doing what Hannibal does, right? He's transforming somebody really in part against their will. Although they're partially wanting it to happen. In Vertigo, it's sort of for other reasons that don't have to do, I mean, although similar reasons.
Yeah.
Like similar reasons in the sense that Will is sort of torn about whether he's going to allow this darkness of his to come out. But with Judy Barton, but Will also, there's an issue of does concomitantly, is his, he can allow his love for Hannibal to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Judy Barton is somewhat complicit with this transformation that Scotty's doing on her because she wants the love. So that's similar. But Scotty is the both the transformer and the transformed. So he can be seen both as Hannibal and Will, although Hannibal also is transformed by the things he's doing. But really, he is trans... He starts out, much like Will, as a person with a mental issue, like a psychological issue that is going to make them vulnerable to having, to being manipulated,
mm-hmm.
emotionally manipulated, because he has vertigo. But what really happens is that the process of being emotionally manipulated and then what he does in response to having been emotionally manipulated and the feelings that have been engendered by his having been emotionally manipulated into falling in love with this person who is really Judy Barton, but he thinks is Madeline, is just a descent into further and greater madness and murderousness. I mean, Scotty is ultimately responsible. He kills her. I mean, he is responsible for her death, right? I mean, even if not, if he doesn't do the push, he's responsible, much like I guess you could say, even if Will is not the person who in this episode kills Hannibal, had the orderly done it, he still would have been responsible. It's what he wanted to happen. It's what Scotty in Vertigo actually wants to happen. He wants her dead. So I think this is really fascinating. I feel like you could write a huge academic paper on this, but can I just tell you what I was thinking about the same topic of Vertigo? Sure. When you brought up the Vertigo kiss? Well, first of all, this is just an aside. I just thought of another Hitchcock reference, which is we had spoken about how the shot where Will's face is superimposed over the grate and the blood, Hannibal's blood is pouring in it. Reminded me of a later thing that happens in season 3, but it's Psycho. It's the end of Psycho.
It's the final dissolve in Psycho, yeah.
And we've already had references to that scene in Psycho last season when Hannibal puts the blanket around Will, that it's like from the same scene, actually. She has a little chill. And this is Psycho, where you see like the skull teeth superimposed over Tony Perkins's face. So absolutely. I just thought there's another Hitchcock reference going on in this episode.
Yep.
But here, this is what I was thinking about in terms of Vertigo, and there's something that sort of precedes it, is that in this episode, we see all of this imagery of water and blood, that it's everywhere, right? It's from the first moment when Freddy goes into the observatory, and it's in Will's sink repeatedly, and it's in the room behind the pool, and there's blood and water all over the place. And I just kept thinking about, well, like blood and water feels like birth, right? You have blood, fluid, something's being born. It's a painful process. And that's happening with Will, right? He's having this transformation, but it's an extremely painful process. And I just started thinking about that. The blood and water just made me think of baptism, that there's this idea of being baptized and reborn. And baptism is where you're submerged in water, but really it's supposed to be, I think, like you're being cleansed by the blood of Christ. Mm-hmm. And what's supposed to be happening in a baptism is like your old self is being washed away, you're cleansed, and you emerge into a new life where you've committed to God and a belief system. And I think you can see this is happening with Will. He is being transformed, and we have all of this blood and water imagery that seems to be referring to birth or rebirth or the evolution of a person. So when you look at the antler scene, which is the most physical representation of his transformation, at the end of that scene, he's in pain, he's in agony, and like you can think of this again as sort of like a birthing process where transformation or giving birth to a new life or a reborn life is painful. But at the end, he looks almost ecstatic. When he lifts his head at the very end, he's been in pain, but he almost has like a look of agonized ecstasy on his face, like a saint, like a martyred saint almost. Also, I just as an aside, the antlers are actually in him, which is what Dr. Gideon says about murder is in mm-hmm. him. So I just thought that's an interesting aside. So that's going on with this like baptism and rebirth imagery. And then Hannibal is then seen as Christ, who is killed and reborn, killed and resurrected. And I think there's also blood and what, I mean, there's certainly, of course, an irony in seeing Hannibal as a Christ figure, except that we have seen Hannibal equated as a figure of God or godlike or a fallen angel or a devil, you know, a figure like yep. that.
And we've seen him get dunked and pulled out of the water in correct. This episode.
Correct. Yeah. And I think you can say that Hannibal is also experiencing a rebirth or a transformation. And here it's specifically as being reborn as someone who is both physically and emotionally vulnerable to Will. So I think that's going on. And this is what made me think about Vertigo and the Vertigo kiss scene, which is that kiss, you, I think, refer to it as, it sort of seals an unholy compact between the two of them. It's the transforming of a love object or an obsessional object. But in a way, it's also, he's bringing a life out of death, right? Madeline is dead. He's recreated her. He's made Madeline be reborn. So again, there's this sort of like idea of rebirth. And he even sees during the spinning the place where the death happened. Mm-hmm. And then he chooses to move forward with this person he's brought from death into, like, into the world. She almost appears to him actually as a spirit, because she appears in that weird green light.
Yeah, she goes into, yeah, it's almost like it's a Lazarus. She goes into a cave, right? And he's pacing around and he's waiting. And that scene takes a few beats too long for her to come out of the bathroom. And it's very suspenseful. And then she comes out and yes, she's bathed in green light and fog and slowly emerges from it.
And I think the ultimate thing about this scene is that with Will is that you can see this as the real moment he knows he's going to kill. It's the moment he says, this new self, this part of myself is going to emerge. I'm going to be reborn. I'm being reborn in blood. And I think that's what I thought about with this. So it's not, you know, obviously not as complex or deeply analyzed as what you've discussed, which is really super interesting to me. But like, I just think that stuff's there too. So there did seem to be a real lot of things you could pull out of Vertigo in reference to this.
Absolutely. Thinking about a previous conversation, is there a little bit of Saint Sebastian and Hannibal there too? It's more straight. Christ.
He's very Jesus-y.
He's very Jesus-y. It really, yeah, it's hard to deny.
So let's move on from Vertigo, although I could really talk about this all day. I just feel like he should write a paper on this. But so some of the things we talked about earlier is you had brought up the issue of Jack as a proxy for Will in terms of what Hannibal wants from Will. And I thought more about it in rewatching, and I think this is really a very apt observation. It's a very apt observation. You're a very apt observer. Because like we said, he's kind of recreating his first quote-unquote date with Will. It's breakfast, right? It's the morning after a profound shared experience. And he is talking about being a better friend than a therapist, which is what he wants to be to Will. And it's been discussed many times. And he wants Will to believe he is a great friend. He really wants Will to understand that what Hannibal did was the right thing and that it was done out of friendship, in the way Jack mistakenly believes Hannibal did the right thing and that it was done out of friendship.
And Jack says the words, you're a great friend, and it kind of stops Hannibal in his tracks there. You see him in his low-key or Mads, you know, brief, instantaneous way. He's like, huh.
Yes.
I like trying those words on for size.
Yes. And then in the final scene, I think this is really borne out. You're thinking about this in the final scene, because in the last scene, there are really two proxies for Will in that room. The orderly is a proxy for Will, who calls himself a proxy. He literally calls himself a proxy. And Jack, in a way, we've seen as a sort of a proxy for Will in Hannibal's eyes. One proxy wants to kill Hannibal. The other proxy wants to embrace and save Hannibal. And this is their relationship. Like, that's it. This is the question that hovers over the relationship. Which thing do they really want, or which way will it end up going? But murder and love are both opposed and completely linked. And so that the idea that these two people in this last scene are serving in certain ways as proxies for Will's emotional feelings towards Hannibal is really, really interesting.
I love that.
One thing I did just want to note is that Hannibal was serving Jack coffee out of that Belgian balancing siphon. We brought it up. But also, it is the orderly who's preparing Will's breakfast. And so I thought this was interesting that in each case, there is a quote-unquote friend serving breakfast to a quote-unquote friend, but in each case there is only one person who really believes the friendship exists, and it's not Will or Hannibal. So I just thought that was also very interesting. I did want to mention, because you know I get mad at Jack so often for a lot of things, but boy, he goes and finds Beverly the morning after his wife tries to kill herself. Like, he is just having a bad day. Like, things are just in a bad place for him. And I did kind of feel bad about him, about that. We forgot to discuss the fact that when Will goes to do his recreation, the Wendigo is there. He sees the Wendigo like behind the glass, the plasticized slides that Beverly's in.
True.
And the Wendigo actually emerges when Will, speaking as the killer, speaking as Hannibal actually, says, "She found me." And then the Wendigo emerges. And this is, I have a lot of other things, but let me just sort of stop for a moment with this one. But we had talked a lot about why Will doesn't tell Jack who the killer is. And we said, you know, he just can't do it anymore. Jack doesn't believe him. And Jack's a toxic boss and he's not going to believe this anyway. But I do think there is a moment that you see on rewatch where Will seems really struggling. He wants to tell Jack. And then he just sort of sighs and says, "You're going to have to find this out yourself." And I think the other reason he's not telling Jack here is for the reason he actually says overtly to Alana later, which is he doesn't want anyone else to get killed because they've listened to him. And this is part of the distancing thing that's going on with him.
Oh, so he's not just disgusted. He's also being protective.
Yes, I think it's both. Like, I just thought that was another reason.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
I had a note, why is he so happy eating Beverly? But you've answered that question for me. Okay, another thing that Gideon says, which I just don't know why I didn't pick up on this phrasing, but when he's telling Will you're going to have to kill Hannibal because he's the devil, what he says is, "You want him, you'll have to kill him." And I just think there's two meanings here. If Will wants him romantically, it's linked to killing him, like we've just been talking about. Mm-hmm. And Will has to kill him so he doesn't want Hannibal or what Hannibal is offering him. Like, Hannibal has to be killed for that reason. And I just thought that was also just a line I missed, or a reading of that line that I missed.
Yeah, but that sort of rings a bell with the Vertigo comparison, yes. Right? To have her, he has to kill her.
Yes, yes, yes. One other thing, we had talked about this line that when Hannibal says to Chilton, like, "Oh, you can psychically manipulate, you know, you can psychically drive people with, you know, hypnotics or whatever." And we were wondering why he said it at that point and whether he was sending a message to Chilton that Chilton should be psychically driving either Will or Gideon or both to cover up for the both of them. I thought maybe there's something else happening here, which is that Hannibal is sort of subtly warning Chilton, if you try and say that I psychically drove Will, I'm going to say you psychically drove him to say that. And I think that maybe that's another reading of this. And also, it may be some foreshadowing about the way Hannibal drove, we're going to see Hannibal drives Miriam Lass in a way that's going to implicate Chilton. So I just thought those are some other things that might be going on with that.
One thing related to the good friend thing, and this is just a small point about just good writing, it sets it up nicely for that final scene. We've established Jack early on saying to Hannibal, you're a great friend, you're looking out for me. You had asked last time about the fact that, or you'd pointed out last time that Hannibal says he's got a gun, but he's just got a dart gun. Jack takes Hannibal's word for it, I think, in part because we've established that Jack really feels like Hannibal is looking out for him. And Jack very quickly shoots him because he doesn't raise the dart gun to try to shoot him. He just shoots him.
There is a kind of a returning of the favor here, right? Like you saved my wife and there by doing so, in a sense, saved my life. And now I'm responsible for saving your life. And that's what friends are.
Just one little interesting thing that I thought, a small moment with the conversation between Alana and Will. Will says something that I hadn't really thought about before. He says, people think he's crazy because he hasn't let people learn much about him.
That's with Freddie.
Freddie. And Freddie says to Will, and you understand him? And Will gives this, like, he goes, duh, laugh.
I cannot believe. He's like, well, I mean, it's funny you bring this up because I was thinking about how, from the beginning, Will's very snotty and kind of bitchy a lot. Yeah. and superior. And, like, this is really a perfect example of him doing this. Like, what do you fucking think? Of course I understand him. Like, I'm the greatest. I understand. I understand everything and everyone.
But is there also a little blush of, don't you know we're in love? Like, is there like a little of that there too? Like, of course, you know, like, right. You know, like, he's almost like blushing while he's doing it too.
It was a very good moment, and I really we did skip over it last time.
Now I have a bigger thing, not super big, but okay, slightly bigger thing. You mentioned how the orderly is the one who's giving Will breakfast, and I was watching that, and then I noticed, which I hadn't noticed before, the orderly is also the one who puts the mask on Will.
Yes, he's there all the time. He's hovering around constantly.
But I think the fact that he's actually putting that mask on Will is significant. And it got me thinking more about masks and the role of that mask. At first, I thought it was just cool that the mask is clear plastic. But the mask is clear for more than a reason, for more than just because it looks cool. It's a mask that's not a mask.
Because you can see.
You can see Will through the mask. It is meant to disguise the killer behind it, but it allows you to see the killer behind it. Right?
Yes.
So it's in a way, by being a clear mask, sort of symbolizes Will's, the sort of undeniability of who Will is becoming. Mm-hmm. It's a mask that goes on a killer, but you can see him through it. And it got me thinking a bit more about masks and the role of masks in horror, and when are masks used and what do they mean to people. And I was actually, coincidentally, I was listening to this podcast, The Colors of the Dark podcast, which is a Fangoria horror podcast, And they happen to be speaking with an academic on that episode. It's the most recent one before we recorded this, about masks in horror and how ubiquitous they are. And we kind of take it for granted that we know what masks mean. And there's a lot of horror movies that just use masks and try to find cooler and cooler masks or weirder masks or scarier masks, but they can be used in kind of a profound way. Like in Halloween, you know, famously John Carpenter referred to Michael Myers as the Shape in Halloween, mm-hmm. in the script, mm-hmm. and didn't name him. Mm-hmm. And his mask is like a blank slate. Mm-hmm. And what this discussion I was listening to reminded me of is that masks serve all these different purposes. They're there to conceal, but they're also there to embolden. A mask gives you permission to behave more like yourself, even though it obscures yourself. Mm-hmm. And when Hannibal's eating Beverly's kidney, that mask really is opaque, and it's actually concealing it. Like, that's a secret. Whereas this clear mask of Will's is not keeping Will a secret. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's saying that Will and the killer are one and the same. It's not serving the purpose that a mask serves.
Right, right.
It's revealing him.
Yes, yes, yes. That's really, really very smart. I like it. There's a lot of talking about the masks too. So yeah, that it's very interesting that it's a clear mask, and I never really thought about the meaning of it. You're right, other than it was cool looking, but I do think it is a mask that reveals. A couple of other things, you know, we had talked about Hannibal being surprised by the fact that Will sent the orderly after him, and it's funny because on Twitter earlier today, somebody posted kind of in an almost jokey way, like, why did Hannibal have to kill Beverly? Why couldn't he have just kept her alive like Abigail and Miriam Lass? And
we both
answered, and I answered that because he had to display her to send Will a message. This is what's going to happen if you send people after me. And you responded that he also needed to do it for emotional satisfaction because he is removing someone else who is close to Will, because he wants Will for himself. And that's part of why he was so relishing eating her. So I just thought that was funny. I had made a note about it, and then someone commented on it today. So the biggest thing I kind of want to talk about is the last scene, the conversation between Hannibal and the orderly. And there's two things. One being Hannibal saying, like, you think you know Will Graham, but he's not a murderer. And then Hannibal responding when Matthew Brown, the orderly, says, you know, why do these people cling to a life that means nothing? And Hannibal says, I know why, because life is precious. So I guess my first question is, why is he saying Will is not a murderer, number one? And number two, what does he mean about life being precious? Because we've talked so much about how Hannibal thinks of people as pigs or as insects, and that, you know, life is so random that it can be decided in a coin flip, and that he is very aware of the possibility of his own death, and that actually exhilarates him and makes him appreciate his own life more. But he is so willing to take lives. What does he mean when he says life is precious? Is he saying his own life is precious to him? Or is he saying even for a pig or an ant, they value their own lives? And taking a life has less meaning unless it's precious to somebody. Like, in other words, part of the pleasure in taking life is that those people find it precious. So he's really taking something of value from them, or what? Matthew Brown is really describing these people the way Hannibal described Nicholas Boyle to Abigail, right? Like clamoring after a life that had was, you know, met. The most important thing about the life he clung to was that it changed you when you killed him. Like his death was more important than his than the life he clung to. But now here he is saying life's precious.
Well, I like your take that he prefers to eat humans over animals because he's taking more, he's exerting more godlike control by taking human life and eating people. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I think what Hannibal actually says is, I know why they know life is precious. And to say they know life is precious, is that to say, he doesn't say because life is precious.
Is that what he says? They he says, know they life know is precious?
Life is precious. And I thought at first I heard him say they think life is precious, but he says they know life is precious. And what does he mean by they know life is precious? Other than to say, I know their lives are precious to them, like you're saying. I think that makes a lot of sense. Is he also saying that Will's life is precious to him? Is he saying some lives are precious? Do lives only become precious to Hannibal when he's ending them and eating the people? That's a precious.
Or is life also yes? Is life precious too? That it, because in taking it, transformation occurs. It's just something to think more about because, on the surface, it feels very much in conflict with a lot of the things we've said about him. That, and yet we also know he does take great pleasure in many things, like you said, art, music, and all the horrors the world has to offer. So certainly, while he anticipates and the specter of his death is always with him, and he would meet death on its terms if the terms were correct, in other words, Will killing him, his own life is obviously quite precious to him because he in a strange way has embraced everything the world does offer him. Murder, eating people, art, music. You know, I don't know. It's just sort of it's something to think about in terms of his worldview. He's complicated.
He's complicated, but it's also he's also being, why don't we, let's do the exercise of assuming that everything Hannibal says means the opposite or means is masking a underlying motivation. What would the opposite or the underlying motivation of saying they know life is precious be?
Well, it would be that they cling to life, but they're wrong to do so. But it doesn't feel like that's what he's saying.
And what does he mean by Will's not a killer? Does he not a killer? Does he mean Will's not a killer yet?
I don't
somebody
know.
Else, because Gideon says that earlier.
I don't know. And it also really kind of also begs the question of, is he not a killer just because this didn't happen? Like, because the result was prevented, does it make him not a killer? Because he was willing to do it. I mean, he certainly is in the mind of, he has the mind of a killer. He has the intentions of a killer. Like, do you have to have actually, I guess maybe you actually have to have achieved the goal to be a killer? But it is
weird because he says two things that in this conversation that don't make a ton of sense. He thinks Will is a killer and he wants Will to be a killer, and he doesn't really seem to think life is precious or that other people's lives are precious. He doesn't really acknowledge that other people even have the capacity to have precious lives or that it matters. at least it doesn't matter.
Unless we're learning. Has life taken on greater preciousness in his mind because Will's in it?
It could be, and it could be also part of why he smiles so broadly when he tastes Beverly's kidney. It's not just an exercise of power or punishment or teaching someone good manners, like his usual reason for killing. This is a much more precious, he's taken a more precious life, and it tastes better to him because of its importance.
Well, that sort of
maybe fits. Maybe it's occurring to him that life is precious.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot to think about with it. I think both these things leave us with thoughts. I would really ask if anyone has thoughts about this that's listening, please let us know your thoughts, because I'm very struck by it.
It's a puzzle.
So do you have any other thoughts about this episode?
I think I went ahead and shared quite a bit of my thoughts.
Ditto.
Good.
Okay. All right. That's good. So we'll be back next time. And the episode next time is Furumono. And we'll discuss it.
Now, can I just say one more? Now that we're done, can I just say one more thing about Vertigo?
Of course you can.
One thing I also noticed that I don't think I'd ever really picked up on, or at least if I had noticed it, I didn't pick up on it in this way, is that Jimmy Stewart does something really subtle in the scene when she comes out of the closet, the bathroom, and reveals herself to him. He has been pushing so hard for so long for her to be an exact replica of who she was. Buying her clothes, getting her to dye her hair.
What she says, it's just such a little thing.
It's
just,
yeah. What difference could it make to you or something like that about dyeing her hair a different color? He's been so intensely into it. And there's this huge buildup of suspense waiting for her to come out and reveal herself. And at this point in the movie, things have gotten so surreal and so melodramatic that we're just in a swirl of intensity now and craziness, that it feels like we're operating with broad strokes. But he does this one thing. She comes out of the bathroom and he looks at her and he's struck. She, as the audience, were like, she, okay, now she's looks exactly like she looked. And he's looking at her and he's staring at her and he's fixed on her and he's like struck by how she looks. And then for like a microsecond, his eyes flick and he kind of tilts his head. And this, for a second, this panic crosses over his face where he thinks there might be a hair out of place. It's like he's kind of peers behind her for a microsecond, like, he's scared that it's not quite right. And then it sort of just returns. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't remember. I just don't remember that specific thing.
Watch the scene. I put it in the show notes. Just watch it.
I will.